Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Godwin Vasant Bosco. He's an ecologist based in the Nilgiris Mountains, working to restore forests and grasslands. He's been conducting interdisciplinary research for the past 9 years and is the author of the book Voice of a Sentient Highland. He's also an inventor with 2 patents registered in Finland for alternative technology applications. So first, thank you for your work on the world, and second, thank you for being on the program.
Thanks a lot, Derek. It's great to be speaking with you.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be speaking with you, too. So let's talk. First, let's introduce people to the Nilgiris Mountains.
Yeah, sure. So the Nilgiris are very ancient mountains. They're about 2.5 billion years old. And they occur in the southern part of India. And they form a connection with these long chain mountains called the Western Ghats, which run along the western coast of the Indian Peninsula. And the Nilgiris are an elevated plateau, tableland, which is higher than the Western Ghats, rest of the Western Ghats that you find in Peninsular India. And There are three sister landscapes which are very similar to the Nilgiri plateau, and it's the Nilgiris, and then there's the Palani Anamalais, which is south of the Nilgiris, and then there are the central highlands in Sri Lanka. So these are the mountains that you find here in the southern part of the Indian subcontinent. They're very similar, all three of them. And they have some very unique characteristics also.
So what are some of the unique characteristics and who lives there in terms of especially plants and animals?
Okay, so the Nilgiris are very rich, are very biodiverse. And in my book, I describe it as a microcosm of Earth. And this is because the entire span of the Nilgiris is about 5,000 square kilometers. And within that, you have almost 6 to 7 vegetation types. And these are dry deciduous forests, moist deciduous forests, scrub jungle and savanna and rainforests. And then a unique ecosystem called the Shola grassland ecosystem, which is a high elevation montane, tropical montane system. And then you have hills forests, which occur on the slopes of the plateaus. And so there are 6 to 7 vegetation types in a very small area. And because of this, the biodiversity is also extremely rich. You have all kinds of animals from the smallest mammal, which is the pygmy shrew, to the largest land mammal, which is the Asiatic elephant. And in fact, both of them are related because they have common ancestors. And you have black panthers, you have tigers, you have otters, you have indigenous native fish in the streams, different kinds of fish, you have damselflies, a huge amount of insect diversity and amphibian diversity, and close to 4,000 to 5,000 species of plants. And the diversity is very huge, is very large here. And a lot of the species are also endemic to this region, which means they're not found in anywhere else in the world. And because of these vegetation types and huge amount of diversity, the number of indigenous peoples groups that are present here, that were present here, and that who still live here, is also numerous. There are close to 25 to 30 different types of indigenous peoples communities who lived in this small region, and each of them had their own ways of relating to the landscape, connecting to the landscape, and different languages, different ways of life, all living in a certain type of exchange with each other, and in harmony, and completely sustainably with the environment. So this is another reason why this place is like a microcosm of Earth, because there's an example of every single way in which you can live sustainably with the planet, and that all these indigenous groups showed.
What do you mean by different ways? So does that mean that there were those who relied primarily on fish and those who did small-scale farming? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so for example, on the western side, where we get the heaviest rainfall, is where there are the rainforests. And there were people called the Cholanaikan people who lived there. And right now, they are the only surviving hunter-gatherer community in the whole of mainland India. They're the only surviving hunter-gathering community. And they lived along these massive rivers, rainforest rivers. And they primarily fished and gathered for forage inside the rainforests. Whereas like higher up in the plateau where the ecology is dominated by grasslands, there were the pastoral communities, completely dependent on buffaloes and grazing. So yeah, their lifestyles were completely different from the Cholanaikan community. And then there were other groups called the Irulas who lived in certain slopes, like northern slopes and in the foothills. And they practiced shifting cultivation. And of course, they were hunter-gatherers also. But they also practiced shifting cultivation. And then there would be some exchange of grains between the Irulas and the Todas. So the Todas, who lived on top as pastoral communities, would exchange dairy products such as ghee for millets that the Irulas and other groups called Kurumbas produced. And the Kurumbas, they were expert at collecting honey. And so they would specialize on that and exchange that with other communities. So similarly, all these different communities, depending on their location in this biosphere, had different ways of living and engaging with the land and living in exchange and harmony with each other.
So I want to go a different direction for a second before we continue on with all of this, which is, you mentioned that the mountains are really old, and how does that what does that mean to have a really old mountain system in terms of and if my question isn't clear, which it probably won't be, then you can ask me to try again.
Okay.
What does it mean in terms of the mountains being that old in terms of the evolutionary processes of life itself? I mean, because mountains that old are basically as old as life on the planet, right?
Exactly.
So what does that mean? What does that? I don't know about if mean is the right word. What is that? How does that manifest? What does that mean for the evolution of life on that place, for that to be so old? Is this making any sense at all?
Yes, it is. And I've tried looking at this question also when I was writing the book, to go as deep as possible and see how the evolution of the mountains have interacted with life and how they've co-evolved almost. And so yeah, before going to that, I just like one of the names for this mountain at a certain part of the Nilgiris is Mudumalai. And Mudumalai means ancient mountain. So there has been an understanding that these mountains are very ancient. And it's not just through science that we know now that these mountains are very ancient, and by dating rocks or digging very deep in the ground, that we know that they're ancient. The indigenous people have known that these mountains are very ancient and have held that in regard in the ways they've worshipped and worship these mountains. So in terms of life, these mountains started forming when the Indian peninsula or if we can call it that, because it was very different when it was part of other supercontinent formations. These mountains were already forming during Gondwana formation and before that, during Colombia, and when the Indian plate was next to Antarctica. So very, very ancient processes have helped form these mountains, and you have relics of very ancient species also, like tree ferns, which predate dinosaurs, and that are still found in the forests here, and several bryophytes and epiphytes which grow on the trees, which might have grown on rocks or different kinds of plants before, but they still grow on the tree trunks here, and you can see them. And so the vegetative composition is composed of a wide range of species that evolved at different periods and at different parts of the world. For example, there are species that evolved and diverged in South America, which have found their ways into the composition here. And since the Nilgiris occur in the south of India, in between three or four major species diverging like points, which is Africa, Himalayas, and Myanmar and Bhutan, you have species that have traveled over millennia that make up the composition here. So it's a very rich composition, and of plants all over the globe and from different geological time periods. And you can see this in the way the plant communities exist here. And like I was telling you, that there are different vegetation types that you would usually have to travel thousands of kilometers across Earth to cross between one to another, but you just have to cross like 30 or 40 kilometers to see these vegetation types. So the ancientness, if I can say, and has helped in gathering all these precious elements from different parts of Earth, and to represent it in as a microcosm, I would say. And and while walking the forests and trying to experience them, you can feel the age and the journey that life has taken in these mountains.
So before we go to more about that journey in specific, Can you talk about, in a few of those different biomes, some of the sort of, in the current day, some of the most important species? So, for example, when you think of the Great Plains, two of the primary species in the United States, two of the primary species who helped form the plains were buffalo and prairie dogs. And when we think about the redwood forest here, two of the primary species would be redwood trees and salmon. Who would be some of the primary, over the last, let's say over the last 10,000 years or last 1,000 years even, who would be some of the primary keystone species for some of the different biomes?
Okay. So,
like this here, I live in redwood forest, and it really is called a salmon-dependent forest.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And so who are the, if you'd say something dependent grasslands or something dependent jungle? Recognizing, of course, that insects and fungus and everybody else play their roles.
So the entire the entire like repertoire and ecosystem, if you can say, works together, and they are intertwined, and they help maintain and form these vegetation types. And the plants themselves are like they've shown a lot of movement and adaptation to various characteristics like frost and glaciers retreating, ice age retreating, and so there has been a lot of plant movement, and for example, the grasslands on top are maintained by frost and fire and aspect and orientation. And at the same time, the herbivores, the large herbivores such as bison and they actually call the Indian gore by and sambar deer have also helped maintain the grasslands. And people also, people who have been dependent on the grasslands have also understood what's needed for the grasslands, like fire or frost, and have worked along with these aspects, and their firing regimes are in sync with these aspects. And and in some of the forests below, you can say that like elephants play a big part in controlling how much trees occur, and they maintain the openness and allow grasses to dominate, and which then helps other herbivores such as deer and then the carnivores also. So elephants play a big role in the lower parts of the biosphere. And I haven't really thought that much on how other animals are helping to maintain these forests and keep these forests going. It's very interesting.
So let's start to transition toward the question of sentience in the mountains themselves, and in help me out here. So answer the question that you wished I would have asked here about sentience in the mountains.
Okay, so I'll just tell you a bit about my journey here and how I came upon this understanding. And so. Like I was telling you, this whole region has a huge amount of biodiversity and diversity in vegetation types. It's also a microcosm of Earth because it has a huge amount of problems also. Like every single ecological problem that you would find on Earth is also found in this region. And a lot of what I said and described as forests and homes of indigenous people and animals is severely reduced, and there's very little of it that remains. And it was like this when I came here 8 to 10 years ago also. So which is also why I really do not get to see how it would have been before. And a lot of the animal populations are in stress, and there are invasive species that have taken over large tracts of land. So it's not like how it was before. So there's actually very little that remains of a healthy ecology. So when I came to understand this, and when I found this out, I wanted to work towards regrowing the forests and grasslands. And so I set up a nursery for native plants, and I started growing the native species, and tried to work with different stakeholders to try and convince them to try and give more space for native ecology, so you can try and grow it back. So that's what I started doing. And for 4 or 5 years, I was doing that. I was working on various projects of ecological restoration, and I was also studying the ecology and the changes that were happening to them. So at one point, I found out that climate change was having a major impact on the ecology of this region. And I found out that forests, rainforests and cloud forests, were starting to die, and old standing forests, old growth forests, were starting to die. And then I started looking at the causes of why this would be happening. And I did a long-term study to try and find out the causes. Then I found out that the reason for the death was excess CO2 in the atmosphere. So what is happening is that trees are actually growing faster and dying faster. Their life cycles are being speeded up, and this is something that's happening all over the planet. It's happening in the Amazon. It's happening in the forest in the northern hemisphere. It's happening in Africa. It's happening. The baobab trees in Madagascar and Africa are dying. Cedars in Lebanon are dying. Cedars in New Zealand are dying, and this is a it's a huge global phenomena that's happening. And so this brought out many questions. One is I was starting to question, like, if I'm going to be planting trees and want to restore lands back, but if forests themselves are starting to die, then what's the point? Like, these trees that I'm planting are also going to grow and face the same situation. We're putting them in danger. And so then I thought that I found out that this phenomena was not being talked about in media enough, and it wasn't being spoken about in the climate summit programs. They weren't talking about the collapse of forests because of excess CO2, because they still wanted to see forests as a sink for carbon, and that if we can plant trees, that we can huge amount of trees that we can sequester carbon, and that could help mitigate climate change. But no one was talking about the fact that the atmosphere is already so toxic that trees are succumbing, and that if it gets worse, it's just going to get more severe and more widespread. So that's when I really started to think, like, how do we get this information out, and how do we get people to see that that we really have to go carbon negative now, and we have to stop trying to work on mitigatory solutions, and I really wanted to basically save my forests and stop these trees from dying, and so I went back to the mountains for answers, so I'd found out that excess CO2 was causing the decline of forests because of my spatial understanding of these forests here. And because I found out that it was because of the variations the forests were showing according to topography and climate and rainfall, that I could correlate that this was happening because of excess CO2. I didn't use any major fancy CO2 chambers that cost millions of dollars or anything like that to try and find the causes. So I went back to that spatial knowledge that I had built up. And this time of all the three sister landscapes, and then I really looked deep into the topography and the positioning of mountains and peaks. And I've always questioned, like, why a certain mountain is shaped a certain way, and why a plateau is shaped a certain way, and whether it, is there some kind of a pattern or correlation, and then I found out that there was actually a very high amount of precision in the way the plateaus are shaped, and in the elevation of mountains and in their shapes, and this precision, like, fascinated me. And then I dug deeper and deeper, and then I found out, and parallelly I was also looking at ecology and the changes that were happening because of climate change. And then I found out that the ecology was actually trying to tell us what to do, and that because it's been affected by different kinds of huge amounts of problems, such as invasive species and deforestation. So I was trying to understand how it was working with these invasive species and on all other ecological problems. And it really did seem like the ecology was telling us how we have to be dealing with problems, and this issue of tree death, which is a major global issue. And so while I was building that understanding on the ecology side, I also found out, I was digging deeper about the precision in landscapes and in these landscapes. And then I found out that this high amount of precision could not be random. And so that's when I started, like, documenting the origin and how these mountains would have really formed. So that's how I came upon this sentient aspect, that this huge amount of precision in the landscape was built out of volition, was intentionally created by these mountains. And what that meant was also that the composition of life, of the ecology that's been built by these mountains, has also been done intentionally. And the ability to withstand these huge amounts of pressures from population pressures that are here in South India and ecological pressures was also built intentionally, and that this was to show these ecological messages of what we need to be doing, especially when trees are dying and when forests are dying and grasslands are being choked. So that's a bit about this journey.
So what do you mean by the precision of the landscapes? I don't quite understand what that means.
Okay, so like I was telling you, there are three sister landscapes. No? One is the Nilgiris and Palani Annamalais, which is south of the Nilgiris, and there is a gap that separates these two landscapes. So the Nilgiris is an elevated plateau, and then there's a gap, which is almost sea level, and then there's this other plateau called the Palani Annamalais, and then there's a very big gap, and there's a strait, and there's a small sea, and then there's Sri Lanka, and then you have a very similar landscape called the Central Highlands in Sri Lanka, and these are sister landscapes, and they're very similar. They have similar vegetation on that cover the plateaus, and one of the things that I found out was that the highest portions of all these landscapes were oriented towards the highest wind directions, the wind direction which brought the most amount of rain, and then these highest portions also supported the most number of species, plant species, and species diversity were the highest on the portions that faced the highest wind directions. And just below, because all that large amount of rain supported lush rainforests. So this is one example of the precisionist and the accuracy with which these mountains are formed. And so then I thought, like, every other aspect has an equal amount of precision.
So I'm thinking about, we're generally taught that evolution is based on strict competition, sort of the selfish gene theory. And I remember the first time I encountered someone who said that evolution is based on very much on interspecies cooperation and on sort of evolution is on the community scale as opposed to the selfish gene scale. And that took me several years to understand because it went so much against what our entire paradigm is. And so I'm wondering, I mean, what you're saying seems to be going against much of what I mean, wouldn't sort of a mechanistic perspective be that, well, of course, high rain is going to create certain sort of the cause and effect are inverse in that the wind creates that the mountains don't create anything, that the mountains are passive participants who are ground down by wind and rain over the millions of years. And then how help us walk through the what you're saying in relation to that. Do you see what I'm trying to get at?
Yeah, I understand that. Yeah. So yeah, I've like it's taken me 9 years to write this book, so I've spent like a lot of time thinking about the questions that will come through and that people will ask when I say something like this. So it's for me, like, yeah, it's been clear because of looking at it from from every angle possible. So for example, so this location, which is the southern part of the Indian subcontinent, which is where the northeast monsoon and the southwest monsoon coincide. And these are major monsoon systems that provide huge amounts of water for the entire Indian subcontinent. And at this location, and these monsoons started intensifying about 90 million years ago. And this is the exact time when these three sister landscapes also rose up in elevation. And then, like I was telling you, all the three highest portions. So they are already elevated plateaus, but then within the plateaus there are higher sections. There are portions which are higher than the rest of the plateau, and all these sections are oriented towards the highest, like, and strongest wind directions. And then when you dig deeper into how these higher sections were formed, it's all different in all the three cases. And then when you dig deeper into the orogeny and just the geological setup of the three sister landscapes, they're all different, but the final manifestation of almost very similar elevation and shape and orientation shows this incredible amount of precision, and it could have only happened if they sense that the monsoons are forming, and yeah.
So how does this relate? There's a friend of mine, and tell me if this relates. Mm-hmm. That a friend of mine's a fisheries biologist, and he and I were sitting looking at the ocean one day, mm-hmm. and he happened to mention to me that the fact that shark skins are rough
mm-hmm.
allows them to swim faster because of turbulent versus laminar flow of the water across their skin.
Mm-hmm.
And when he said that, I just looked mm-hmm. at him. I know that this friend goes to church, and I said to him, so are you saying
mm-hmm.
that you think that there is some sort of design in mm-hmm. this evolutionary process? Mm-hmm. And his response, I thought, was wonderful, which is, there is great intelligence in time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering if there is any relationship between what he said and what you're saying, or if there are different things or similar things or what. And they may be very different. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's great intelligence and time. Yeah.
That basically evolution itself
uh-huh.
becomes very intelligent.
Mm-hmm.
And if it that nature has time, that if you have 1 million years, or if you have 100 million years, or if you have 1 billion years, or mm-hmm. 3 billion years,
mm-hmm.
you have a lot of time to try out various solutions mm-hmm. to various problems,
mm-hmm.
And eventually you'll come up with some really, really smart and elegant solutions. Is that what you're talking about, or are you talking about something else entirely? I want us to get really clear for the listeners.
Okay. Yeah. I agree with that. I mean, it's fascinating. Yes, with time, things like do shape up to being like perfect and really adapted for that time period. What I'm trying to say here is a sensory ability in the land and in the mountains and in being able to sense monsoons and rain, and in and a control in the formation and that it's not random, and that there is they do have an ability to sense these elements as well as life, because only if they had known that rain supports and provides for a lot of life, and if they'd known about the existing forest compositions, and would have they been able to achieve something like this? And yeah, so this is really taking in the intelligence and sensory ability past the animal kingdom and past the plant kingdom, which we're starting to learn now. Many people are starting to talk about the intelligence and sensory ability in plants, and so I'm trying to say that it's there in the land and the mountains also, like how the indigenous people have always been saying from the start. But now here with these landscapes, it's just simple to see, and it's clear because it's got to do with how it supported forests and how it's worked with rain systems, and it's got to do with the shape of the landscape and its topographical features, and it's something that anyone can see and can understand.
So thank you for that, I mean, and insofar as people know my work, they know that I think that rivers are alive and sentient, and
yes,
and mountains are, etc. Mm-hmm. And this may be a really unfair question, mm-hmm. because you aren't a mountain, just like I'm not a river.
Yeah.
But what do these landscapes, and they may want different things too, because they're all very different and individual. But mm-hmm. what do they want? What is their sentience aimed toward?
Okay. So one section of the book, I've tried to look at this question of why are they showing us these clear signs here? Why are they making it so clear for us here? Because the indigenous people have always known about it, but why is this relationship so evident over here? And one thing is that the mountains are showing that the earth wants to support life and provide for more life, and that's the point of processes on the earth and the earth itself, and that's something that dominant human culture is just completely going against. We're killing life on earth, and so maybe the idea was to the intention or maybe the earth's processes knew that a certain species at this point of time would get disconnected and go on this rampage, and that in its ability it should leave some simple messages on the ground, on the topography, on the geology and ecology, that's just visible and clear that the earth is alive, and that it should also be treated as the land is alive, and it should be treated as a living being, and that life should be supported at all times and at all causes. And also probably that maybe it knew that a certain species would go on this disconnect and think that it's the most superior, or that it's the most intelligent, and maybe it's nature showing us that it's that one step higher always, and it's infinitely more complex, and that it needed to show itself, like show it in a clear form over here.
So we have six or seven we have 6 or 7 or 8 minutes left, and mm-hmm. what are the you've mentioned several times the messages that the mm-hmm. land is making very clear. Can you say what the messages are?
So some of the messages are how we deal with problems and solutions. So like I was telling you, this landscape has come under a huge amount of pressure, and so the way in which ecology deals with these pressures, it's almost trying to tell us that it can solve the problems in nature, has the solutions, and it can solve the problems, but we have to allow nature to do it, and we have to give it the space. So it's not that we can continue to do what we're doing and that nature will take care of everything, but we have to step back and allow nature to start repairing this huge amount of destruction that we've done, and that we really have to control what we claim as solutions and what we bring as solutions in claiming that we can solve this whole thing by ourselves and using industrial technological solutions. So I see that the ecology is responding to that idea that we're having. So
this whole time I've been trying to catch up with you as you've been talking.
Yeah. Yeah.
And as you were saying this last thing, it like all of a sudden came clear to me, I think. Mm-hmm. So is part of what you're saying mm-hmm. is that a forest knows better what it needs than we do, and a river knows better what it needs than we do. Is that yes. part of what you're saying?
Yes, yes, yes.
I think I keep thinking about you saying that it's making these lessons very clear for us, and it's like mm-hmm. I don't think it could possibly be more clear than it is that forests mm-hmm. know better what they need than we know yeah. what they need.
Yeah.
And if we lived in a place for 10,000 years, we mm-hmm. might then have a good idea what the forest needs too, but that's because we've lived there for 10,000 years.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
So it's very clear from everything you've said how much you love the forests.
Mm-hmm.
And As a member of this species who is so incredibly disconnected, or we should say a member of this culture that's incredibly disconnected,
yeah.
What should we do? What do you want me to do? What do you want you to do? How do we serve the forests, the grasslands, the rivers? How do we follow their instructions?
So, I think the main thing is in giving them the space to regenerate and giving them the and reducing the pressures on them rather than saying that I'm gonna go and plant a billion trees around the world and then let climate change be solved in climate meetings around the world. And so we have to go carbon negative soon, and we have to stop mining for more materials on the earth. And we've already pushed nature to the last edges. So there needs to be a dramatic shift in that, and we have to give space back to nature and give it time to recover and control our actions. And that's the main action that we'll have to be doing is to stop the destruction and control the action rather than finding new mitigatory solutions.
Well, I love that. I love what you're saying. And I think another thing that I love that you're saying is that I think it's really, really important for us to recognize that the rivers are themselves living beings, and mountains are, and I think that that realization is I think without that realization, there really isn't much hope for anything good.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and that's also one of the things that I tried to was aiming with this book, is that whether it's green solutions or business as usual, everything is based on the destructive utilization of land bases and on mining more and drawing more resources and extracting more resources and damming rivers. And so unless we understand that the land is alive and the earth is alive, the rivers are alive, I think it's going to be hard to stop this destruction and tell people that we shouldn't be doing this to the land bases. They will continue to talk about economic gains and putting the land to an economic use. And so unless we spread this understanding that land is alive and earth is alive, it's going to be very difficult, I think.
Well, thank you so much for that. We have like 30 seconds left. Is there anything else you want to say? I think that everything you've said is brilliant and incredibly important.
No, thanks a lot, Derek, for having me on this. And your work is very inspiring. And I hope this intersects, and I hope to be in touch and work along.
Well, thank you for that. And I would like to mention your book again. It's Voice of Ascension Highland. And I think everyone should read it. So anyway, thank you so much for everything you've said. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Godwin Vasanth Basco. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.